Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Today on the program, intern Hope McKinney talks to Nelson Mandela's former private secretary, Zelda LaGrange, about her new book, a memoir titled Good Morning, Mr. Mandela. LaGrange offers insight into what being one of the world's most revered individuals was like. Hope McKinney offers this profile of the book.
Today I will be speaking with Zelda LaGrange, a white Afrikaner who grew up in segregated South Africa, supporting the regime and the rules of apartheid. Later, she became Nelson Mandela's personal assistant. So, Ms. LaGrange, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thanks. It's very, very hot in New York, but it's good, yeah. Great to be here for the summer.
So first of all, I was wondering, could you give me a little background, a short biography?
Sure. I was born in South Africa, to the north of South Africa in 1970. As you know, that was the years when apartheid ruled our country. Then I finished school and studied at a local institution, and my career really started in government in 1992 as a secretary in one of the government departments. And then in 1994, I applied for a job in Nelson Mandela's office shortly after he was elected president.
Well, it's such an honor to get to talk to you today.
Thank you.
So first of all, what were your political views before working for Nelson Mandela?
Well, growing up and being born in the 70s in South Africa, you know, we were born very conservative or into a conservative environment. We were completely oblivious of what was happening on the outside world. We lived apartheid and segregation, but thought nothing of it. We happily lived the rules dictated by society, by our churches and our schools at the time. And it was only after Nelson Mandela's release that we realized that we were really living in a fantasy world, and that the rest of the world was busy questioning the rules of segregation in our society.
So why do you think he chose you, a white Afrikaner, to work so closely beside him?
Well, at first, I was a very junior typist in his office, and I think after some time, he recognized dedication and loyalty in me, and he obviously saw that I was willing to serve him and be available and completely committed to the job, and he appreciated that, and it was needed for the job.
And how did your family react when you told them that you were going to work for Nelson Mandela?
Well, I don't think they ever thought or could have imagined that I would work so close to Nelson Mandela. So I think at first when they heard I got a job in the presidency, they thought it would be in a back room somewhere, you know, not getting close to the action. And I never even anticipated meeting him. So I didn't have any expectations. I didn't have any interest in meeting him. So it was a combination of fate and I think just the way life worked out for me that I ended up working so close. Team.
Has your family since changed their political views?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And not only my family, but the people around them and their friends. You know, they've been touched and changed because if someone extends such a hand of friendship and caring to your child, you inevitably start having more interest in the person. So that's where it all started. They saw that I was happy at work. They saw that Mr. Mandela and I got along very well. And just that interaction and knowing that I was happy and dedicated at work changed my parents. And right to the end, you know, Mr. Mandela, when he could converse still, he asked about the well-being of my parents. And obviously they met over the years and had a few interactions. So they became very fond of one another. And Mr. Mandela also changed their thinking and their lives by employing me and caring for me the way he did.
So Mandela had a close and warm friendship with the Clintons, a stark contrast to his relationship with President George W. Bush. I was wondering if you could tell me a little more about that.
Yes, obviously because Mr. Mandela was president more or less the same time as President Clinton, you know, they were in office in the same period. There was a much closer relationship between them. But also then President Bush, you know, the whole Iraq invasion came after Mr. Mandela's retirement. Mr. Mandela was very vocal publicly about the United States' involvement in Iraq, and that created some tension between the two of them.
Did they ever meet?
Yes, they met on a few occasions. The last time Mr. Mandela was in the United States in 2006, he met President George W. Bush, and we went to the White House to pay a courtesy call to him. And you would remember that after that, President Bush increased the aid to Africa. So, you know, despite their differences over the years, they still remain respectful to one another, and they retain good relationships.
So what made Mandela such a strong peace negotiator?
Well, I think his ability, you know, to always make choices in the best interests of others, those selfless choices. And I think that is what's lacking in the world right now. You know, people make decisions based on self-interest. And that's why we grapple with these issues around the Middle East and the Ukraine and so on, because we've all become very selfish. And Nelson Mandela is one of the last and few leaders that reminds us of selflessness and how important it is to, even, you know, if it means surrendering power, but always make decisions in the best interest of peace and in the best interest of your neighbor.
So you write an insider's perspective of Mandela's funeral. You mention his widow, is it Mrs. Graca Machel?
Yeah.
Was not consulted on any funeral arrangements, which was taken as a great sign of disrespect. Can you speak to the complicated family dynamic and other problems of the day?
Well, yes. You know, a few years ago when the funeral planning started, Mrs. Machel declined to be involved because at that point Mr. Mandela was still healthy and she was not prepared to plan her husband's funeral whilst he was still alive. So she wasn't involved, and then when he passed on, she was not part of the organizing of the funeral, maybe because she declined before to be involved. But yeah, none of her requests were considered, and I felt, and it's my perspective and my opinion, but I felt that she was hugely disrespected through the whole process of the funeral.
So what is your relationship like with his daughter, ex-wife, and widow?
Well, I've always had good relationships with some people in the family, so I can't say that I've got a good relationship with the whole family or a bad relationship with the whole family. You know, that like in any family, even in my own family, I don't have the same relationships with everyone. And this is a huge family, and it's very complex. It's a very, you know, large, extended family. So I've got good relationships with some of them and not so good relationships with others. I'm very close to his widow, Mrs. Machel. We still speak weekly, and also her children, you know, I'm very friendly with them, and they're very close to me.
So you and Mandela met countless celebrities like Oprah, Morgan Freeman, President Obama, etc. However, Mandela was never really in touch with pop culture, but were you ever starstruck by any of them?
Yes, well, not really starstruck in the beginning. Henry Kissinger visited Mr. Mandela whilst he was still president, and that's the only occasion on which I can remember being starstruck. But quickly after that, I realized people are just all human beings. You know, they've got vices and virtues like all of us. And, you know, working for the biggest celebrity, Nelson Mandela, I had to focus on that and not allow myself to be starstruck and then lose focus in the moment and let him down, really.
You were with Nelson Mandela for many years, but ultimately sacrificed your personal life in order to be 100% committed to him. Was there ever a time that you thought of leaving your position?
Oh, yes, I thought about that every day. you know, you get so consumed by the pressure and so on, and sometimes you just lose sight or focus and you feel like giving up. Every day feels like that, I think, you know, for any person in any job, really. But, you know, the honor and the privilege to work for Nelson Mandela, every time I wanted to give up, I was reminded of that great honor and privilege. And then you pick yourself up and tomorrow is a new day and you have new strengths to take on everything.
Mm-hmm. And you still have many years ahead of you.
Absolutely. Yes, you do. You know, life is so interesting, and the advantage of a bit of age now, I'm not old, but, you know, I've got age on my side now. I've matured a bit. You look at, you know, being young and being so unfulfilled and unhappy about things around you. But then when you get older, you appreciate what you've been through because it strengthened you in so many ways.
So South Africa's education system was one of Mandela's beloved projects. What improvements have been made, or what is the state of today's education system in South Africa?
Well, there's definitely been great progress. you know, people or children in general have access to education, something they were withheld from for many years during apartheid, you know, just quality education. However, we've not succeeded completely. We are in the middle of the academic year in South Africa, and still some schools have not received textbooks. So, you know, we lack a great deal of progress in the one side. On the other side, there has been progress, so it's not all good or bad. We just need to remain committed and deal with other issues, you know, social injustices like poverty and so on. And then these things will all fall in place. But, you know, we remain optimistic in South Africa, and I think we've got a great future. It's just like anywhere else in the world, we have a lot of issues we need to deal with and find solutions to, but we'll get there. You know, we are grateful for Nelson Mandela and people bringing our country freedom. And we often think of that, and that takes us forward. It inspires us again.
I know that you mentioned in the book that when you were first trying to integrate people of color into the government, it was hard to find people who were educated. Was that due to apartheid and the education system at the time?
Yes. If you were of color in South Africa in the apartheid years, you know, you had very limited schools to go to, and you had a very standard level of education. People were not given quality education merely because of the color of their skin. And children went, there was no schools close to them even. You know, they lived in rural areas where they couldn't access schools. Now, I think we've made a lot of progress in that field, in that we've given children access to education in rural areas up to now.
So how old were you when you first kind of came in contact with a person of color and really engaged in a conversation?
Well, I was brought up by a black lady in our house, you know, a domestic worker, as they were known at the time. You know, and most white children were brought up by black people. But, you know, when I say those people, the people that brought us up, those black people, we didn't consider them as part of the majority of other black people. They were special people. We accepted them because they lived and they worked in our houses. But that's how skew our society was. And that's how skew our thinking was in South Africa. You would accept the person working in your house because they're in a way serving you. But the rest of the people outside on the street are not acceptable, simply because they are not the same color as you are. You know, and that's one of the injustices of apartheid, is not allowing people or developing people's thinking properly. You are forced to think and to believe in a particular way because of the system.
Okay, well, it was an amazing book.
Thanks, Hope.
And thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for hosting me.
I hope you enjoy the rest of your time in New York.
I will. I'm sure I will. Thank you. Good luck to you.
You too.
Again, that was Zelda LaGrange, personal assistant of Nelson Mandela. She recently wrote a memoir titled Good Morning, Mr. Mandela, which offers a rare, intimate portrait of Nelson Mandela and his remarkable life, as well as his powerful influence on her own.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the wandering ways of a young artist and writer who mysteriously disappeared in 1934 into southern Utah's rugged canyon country. First this.
I'm Cynthia Buckingham, director of the Utah Humanities Council. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T.D. Foundation. UHC is proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories as part of our statewide tour of the Smithsonian exhibition, Journey Stories. Tune in each week for a new Utah journey story from the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. Everett Roos was 20 years old when he vanished into the canyons of southern Utah, never to be seen again. Born in Los Angeles to bohemian parents, Roos developed early as a writer and artist. Supported by his family, Roos left home to wander the American West to gain experience on the road and feed his creativity. Roos took his first solo road trip at 16, hitchhiking to Northern California, where he camped by the ocean, then to Yosemite before returning to Los Angeles to finish high school. Then he took off again, this time to Monument Valley in southern Utah. Over the next few years, Roos traveled alone using pack horses and burros and traded his art to help pay his way. He traveled through Zion Canyon in northern Arizona, back to the Sierra Nevadas and around the Superstition Mountains. He even lived in San Francisco, where he spent time with now-famous artists Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, and Maynard Dixon. Although he went home occasionally, Roos loved the wilderness and returned again and again to the desert Southwest. Roos was last seen in November 1934 in Escalante, Utah, before heading into nearby canyons. Some believe he was murdered by rustlers, or committed suicide, or died of dehydration. Others maintain that he went to live on the Navajo Reservation or in Mexico. In the last letter sent to his brother, dated just before his disappearance, Roos wrote, "I have not tired of the wilderness. Rather, I enjoy its beauty and the vagrant life I lead more keenly all the time. I prefer the saddle to the streetcar and the star-sprinkled sky to a roof, the obscure and difficult trail leading into the unknown to any paved highway, and the deep peace of the wild to the discontent bred by cities." The fate of Everett Roos remains a riddle, but his writing and artwork, these remnants of his journeys, now provide inspiration to thousands. Sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM HD1 Logan.